Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kelly, your host. Very happy to be here with you because Jimmy Akin's here and we're having fun doing Ask Me Anything. Also, just because of some conversation that happened in the first hour, reminiscing about what it was like to be a child in the 70s. Man, it was crazy. I had forgotten about click-clacks, Jimmy.
Yeah. We should explain just before we came back on, we were talking about wild stuff from the 70s and Cy mentioned avocado-colored household appliances, yeah. And I mentioned all the dangerous games that we had that were then pulled off the market. And we both at the same time said lawn darts, which were these, they were about a foot long, as I recall, and they had a metal core with plastic fins, and you'd throw them and aim at targets on the lawn.
But they were
the
knives for children to throw at each other. It was that's what it was.
Yeah, yeah. And I think adults played lawn darts too, but when you get kids running around and you're throwing pointed metal objects, you know, it's like this is like a little game of javelins with children running around. Yeah. But also click-clacks. What a click-clack was, it was kind of like a bolo, but there were two plastic spheres, hard plastic, that were connected by a cord, and you'd hold the cord in the middle and you'd swing it back and forth so that the the two plastic spheres would clack into each other twice with each swing. And so you'd be going clack, 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 clack. And okay, this is a noisemaker, which is going to annoy parents, but kids love noisemakers.
Yeah.
But the real problem is you're going to hit someone with those hard plastic spheres. You may hit yourself in the head. You may hit another child. You might deliberately throw it at another child to hit them. So,
well, there is some kind
of dangerous toys.
I think that it's Australians that there's some kind of weapon where they put two balls on the end of a string and you throw it. Oh, that's a ball. Oh, yeah. Okay. So, of course, that's what we tried to do. We'd be like, hey, run down the street and I'll try to see if I can get these around your legs. So, children are knocking each other's brains out with heavy plastic balls. The 70s was awesome. It was awesome. After this, we'll throw lawn darts at each other. Amazing, amazing time. But then the fun thing was then you could get in the station wagon with no seatbelts and just play sports in the back of the car. Just
in the back of the
rumble
car,
around
yeah.
in the back of the car while you went on a drive with no air conditioning.
Did that all the time. I should correct myself. It's not bolos, but bolas that are the throwing weapon that you could use to, like, if you're a gaucho in South America, you could, you know, catch an animal by throwing a bola at it. We also had another thing that I really loved. Now, we had some toys that got taken off the market that I don't think they needed to. Like, there was one toy that I really liked that was it was called a Thing Maker. And what it was a it was a little light bulb powered oven, basically. They had the Easy Bake Oven for girls, and they'd make little things that were
was that for girls? I was not aware of that.
Well,
I love the Easy Bake Oven. All right, go ahead.
Primarily for girls, but they also had an equivalent for boys that, or primarily for boys, where you could take these metal trays and pour goop in them, and they had these bottles of goop. And then you'd put that into the Thing Maker, and it would heat it up and cause the goop to solidify as this kind of rubber. And you'd make these little creatures. And they had, like, Creeple People was one of them. And it was these little creepy-looking characters that you could make. And I loved playing with the Thing Maker and the creepy crawlers and Creeple People that I made with it. But because those little metal trays got hot, they ended up taking it off the market. And I think that was maybe a little, I mean, it's not meant for 2-year-olds or 4-year-olds, but I think older children could play with that without it being a problem. Once you learn, you got to have a little patience and restraint while it cools down.
Yeah.
They also
children can deal with heat. Like sometimes we under like For all of human history, children have been dealing with fire and heat. Like, if you're responsible, they can deal with it.
How are they going to learn if they don't burn their fingers once in a while?
Right.
You know, there also was another that I really liked that was, this would have been late 60s or very, very early 70s, but there was a kind of plastic goop. It was thicker than the goop you'd use with the thing maker, which was had a consistency before it was baked, kind of like glue.
Yeah. And then you make a frog or something out of it. You'd be all kinds of cool stuff.
Little monster, right. Something. But there was another kind of goop that came in a tube, and this goop was thicker and more rubbery just out of the tube. And what you, and it was all kinds of different psychedelic colors. And what you do is you'd squeeze out a little bit of this goop onto the end of a straw, and then you'd take the straw and blow into it, and the goop would inflate, and you would have your own custom-built balloon with an irregular shape and all these psychedelic swirly colors on it. And then you pinch it off, and you could play with your balloon. And I thought that was really cool, too. But apparently, the goop was toxic or something, the way they made it.
Get over and, it. Sorry.
Yeah, and so they ended up pulling it off the market. But I thought it was fun.
Yeah. And we did you ever get the opportunity as a child to make a tie-dye shirt? This was also a big thing. You get magically a white t-shirt turns into an actual fashion statement. Like it was a wonderful adventure making the tie-dye t-shirt.
I didn't have that as a child. My parents were a little too square for that.
Oh yeah.
But I do actually have a tie-dye shirt now, but these are ones I bought, not ones I made. I first got a tie-dye shirt because I thought they looked interesting. But I first got one when I was in grad school in college, at least this is the first one I remember. And I had some toe surgery for an ingrown toenail, and I needed to wear Birkenstock sandals after the toe surgery
until my toe
healed. But there's a method to my madness because in grad school I was assigned as a teaching assistant, and I had longish hair and I had a beard. It wasn't as long as it is now, but I had longish hair and a beard, and I was assigned as a teaching assistant in grad school in the philosophy department, and so I was assigned to teach Introduction to Philosophy. And I did very well at it. I had my faculty, student evaluations were top of the department, and they actually gave me an award for teaching. And I remember one day, one of my fellow grad students who was also a teaching assistant, he couldn't make it to one of his classes and asked me to sub for him. And he was not the clearest communicator. And so I went and I taught his class, and this was towards the beginning of the semester, and I had like several students come up to me after the class eagerly saying, "Are you our new instructor now?" Sorry, I'm just filling in. But one of the challenges, because I wanted as part of this course to do Intro to Philosophy, I wanted to cover philosophy of religion, and I wanted, and this was a state school, this was University of Arkansas, so this is not a religious school, and I wanted to be able to present religious content in a way that would not trip sensitivities for students that were, hostile to Christianity or things like that, because, young people. And so what I did was I got out my Birkenstock sandals from my toe surgery, and I bought a tie-dye t-shirt, and I put on the tie-dye t-shirt, and then I go in and teach philosophy of religion, and I can talk about religion without looking like Jerry Falwell. And it worked.
Yeah. There are advantages to being a hippie. You can talk about stuff that the guy with the tie on can't talk about. Let's take a break. The 70s was both worse than, and now I'm recalling better than people remember it. It had some. It was a real mix. Not so good for Patty Hearst, but for the rest of us, there was click clacks. We'll be right back with more Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
We'll be right back with more great answers from Jimmy today on Catholic Answers Live. Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help.
Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
Are you looking to study Catholic theology in a formal way with the guidance of faithful scholars? Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by the Augustine Institute, offering master's degrees in theology, pastoral theology, and Catholic education with flexible study options on campus, online, or both. The Augustine Institute equips students to serve Christ and His church in schools, parishes, dioceses, apostolates, and the home. Learn more today at augustine.edu.
The EWTN On Demand platform features 50 new podcasts every week, as well as an ever-expanding library of audio and video content. For Catholics who want to learn more about their faith, simply using their mobile device, computer, or TV, your favorite EWTN programs are available 24/7. Visit EWTN.com and click On Demand. EWTN is the global Catholic network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin. Ariel wants to know this, Jimmy. Do you prefer the minimal facts approach or the maximal facts approach to defending the resurrection of Jesus?
Okay, so I guess first I should explain what those are for folks who may not be familiar. There have been a variety of approaches to defending the idea that Jesus rose from the dead in Christian apologetics down through the years, and I mean hundreds of years. And one approach that became common in the late 20th century is known as the minimal facts approach. It was popularized, for example, by an apologist who's still with us named Gary Habermas. And in this approach, what you do is you start with only a very few number of claims, and like four or something, that, you know, the early Christians that are agreed upon by everybody, like, Jesus died and Jesus was buried and the tomb was found empty and Jesus' disciples reported him appearing to them, and maybe one or two others. But it's easy to document these claims from our very earliest sources, like one passage that gets appealed to in particular is 1 Corinthians 15, where St. Paul has a creedal statement that talks about Jesus's post-resurrection appearances, and he, and because 1 Corinthians was written about AD 53, this is within 20 years of the crucifixion. And because this is a creedal statement, it's something Paul didn't invent. He modifies it a little. He adds himself on at the end. But it's clear that Paul is quoting pre-existing material here. So that pre-existing material has to be formulated even earlier in that 20-year period. And so there's not a lot of time for distortion to enter the Christian message. And so what you do with the minimal facts approach is you say, well, here are these very few facts that even secular scholars agree to, and we can make an argument that the best explanation for these minimal facts is that Jesus, in fact, rose from the dead. As an alternative, there's sort of the maximal facts approach, where you just pull in all kinds of evidence from everywhere, and you don't focus in particular on these core facts. Well, I tend to prefer something that's sort of a hybrid, that's in the middle. One of my critiques of the minimal facts approach is I think it's a little too minimal. I think that it's missed, in fact, one of the core facts that is very relevant to the question of did Jesus rise from the dead. And that's another claim that's very easy to document and is clearly very early. And it's the fact that Jesus ascended into heaven, because that's the explanation for why you can't just go to Jerusalem and walk down the street and meet Jesus today if you're living in the first century. It's because he's not on earth anymore. He ascended into heaven. And this was witnessed by his disciples, and they preached this, and this is a very early component of the Christian message. And I think that when you add this, it helps you eliminate certain alternatives to the resurrection. Because, like, for example, one theory that's proposed, so what you do in all of these arguments is you make a list of alternative explanations to Jesus being raised, and then you go down that list and evaluate how plausible they all are. Well, one proposal would be, it's what's known as the swoon hypothesis. The idea is that Jesus didn't die on the cross, that he just passed out and swooned on the cross, and they buried him thinking he was dead, when really he wasn't dead. And then he gets to rest in the tomb for a few days and recuperates and thinks he's died and been resurrected. And all of the other disciples think the same thing when he explains it to them. So that's the swoon theory. Now, you can then argue why without the ascension, you can argue, well, that's implausible for these reasons. You know, Romans really knew how to kill you with crucifixion. And that wouldn't explain how Jesus got past the rock that was sealing his tomb. And he would be weak and in really bad health, even if this theory were true. But, and those are all fine. But one of the things that I think is a clincher when you bring in my additional core fact is even if Jesus had swooned on the cross, that wouldn't let him fly. Yeah. And so if this is a core part of the Christian message, you can just eliminate the swoon theory. If the apostles were really preaching, we saw him ascend into heaven, that's a clincher on the swoon theory and on several other theories. So I think the minimal facts approach needs to incorporate this additional agreed upon fact that even secular scholars will admit, yeah, Jesus' disciples preached that he had ascended to heaven. The other criticism that I'd have is I don't think you can do it with just the minimal facts. I think you need, in order to mount a robust defense of the resurrection, I think you need to appeal to what the gospel accounts say, like talking about the fact that the grave was guarded, you know, that there was a guard over the stone, which is only mentioned in Matthew, and talking about, you know, the reactions that the disciples had when there were the reports of Jesus, how they didn't immediately leap to the conclusion he's resurrected. In fact, that was like their third interpretation. Their first interpretation was somebody stole the body. Their second interpretation, when he actually showed up and they could see he's here, was we're looking at a ghost. This is an apparition of a ghost. And then when he demonstrates his physicality to them, their third fallback interpretation is, I guess he got raised from the dead. So that hesitancy to believe that he's raised shows that they were not in a, oh boy, he's going to come back any minute, where they might imagine it. This is a conclusion they came to reluctantly. And so I think in order to mount a robust defense, you need to be able to appeal to some of these facts from the Gospels. So what I do when I argue for the resurrection of Jesus is I start with a minimal facts approach, including my additional minimal fact of the ascension. And then I make the list, and then I go through the list of alternatives, but I allow myself to appeal to additional things in the Gospels that aren't on the initial list of core facts. So I use a kind of hybrid approach between minimal and maximal facts.
All right. Thank you very much, Ariel, for the question. We've got time for another question before we have to take a break. So we'll go to Ghetto Mark 50 wants to know this. Do you know anything about the morality of reality shifting? That is, shifting the consciousness to a different version of reality.
Well, so I guess the first thing I'd say is you can take the principles of Catholic moral theology and apply them to basically any scenario, no matter how weird it is. That's one of the things I do on the Weird Question shows that we do every couple of months. In terms of reality shifting, defined as shifting your consciousness from one version of reality to another, that's a phenomenon that I don't know that we have any evidence for. We don't have evidence that there are different versions of reality. We have evidence of one version of reality, you know, which you can imagine as a timeline that we're traveling down. And we know that exists. At least we have good evidence that it exists. But if people are talking about alternate timelines that, say, branch off from this one, we don't have any evidence that they're real. Now, there are scientists who talk about this as a possibility that, you know, with every quantum event that occurs, the timeline splits. And so one set of options, the fancy word is decoheres. One option decoheres with ours, you know, one timeline branches off. It's no longer part of where we are in this branch and timeline structure. But there's no way to test this. And with no way to test it, that means that this is not actually a scientific proposal. It's a metaphysical speculation. Because one of the things about science is, in order for something to qualify as an item of science, you have to be able to test it in some way. Classically, according to Karl Popper, you need to be able to falsify it. There are counter arguments to that, but you do need to, in some way, be able to see how we could test it. And right now, there's no way to test for the existence of alternate timelines. So I would say this is a metaphysical speculation, but it's not something we have confidence in. And so if other timelines don't exist, then there's no way to shift your consciousness to them. And reality shifting would not be possible. On the other hand, suppose that we are in a branch and timeline system and other timelines are real and we don't have any evidence for it, but suppose they are real. Well, in that case, reality shifting could potentially work. It might or might not, but it could hypothetically work. The question that one of the questions I would have is, what's happening with your consciousness when you come to a decision point and the timeline branches? How do you know your consciousness doesn't itself branch? So, you know, in one timeline, you decide, I'm going to have pizza tonight, and you go down the pizza timeline. In the other branch, you decide, I'm going to have pasta tonight. Let's say you've gone to an Italian restaurant. You decide, I'm going to have pasta tonight, and you go down the pasta timeline. How do you know your consciousness isn't following both of those timelines? There's now two versions of your consciousness. Well, in that case, how would you shift from one timeline to another? It's just your consciousness just automatically branches like everything else. And so it would be difficult to see how that happens, how you would shift from one version of reality to another. Maybe you branch just like everything else does. On the other hand, let's suppose that somehow you do branch. Not that you do branch, but somehow you can shift from one version of reality to another. Let's suppose there's only one version of your consciousness and it travels down whatever branch you choose. So if you choose to order pizza, your consciousness goes down the pizza timeline. If you choose pasta, your consciousness goes down the pasta timeline. Well, in that case, you're kind of doing reality shifting. You know, you're deciding which version of reality you're going to be in. And that would just be something that happens automatically all the time. These other timelines, to me, if they don't have your consciousness in them, they would seem to be less than fully real timelines, but still, you could kind of call this reality shifting. What I think Ghetto Mark 50 is asking about, though, is probably something more dramatic. Let's suppose you chose to have pizza, And you then regretted that. So you went down the pizza timeline and then you regretted that choice and said, man, I wish I had pasta instead. And so you somehow jump your consciousness from the pizza timeline that you're on to the pasta timeline that you're on, that you didn't initially go down. Well, I don't know that that's possible. And if it's not possible, then there's no moral question here. So let's suppose it's possible. Well, in that case, I'd want to know, what are you doing to the version of you, if there was one, that originally went down this timeline? Are you displacing him? If that's the case, then I would say you're doing something immoral by displacing someone who was already here, who made the choice to have pasta, and now you're kicking him out. On the other hand, it might not, consciousness might not work that way. You might just merge. And it's another version of you, and you're not harming anybody else, and you're not harming you. You're not displacing the other you. You're just becoming the other you. In that case, this would be a phenomenon that largely occurs below our level of awareness. But I would say that's at least arguably moral, if you're not doing any harm to yourself or others. So I'd have to know more about how the system is specified to work in order to comment further. But my sense is that this is all very speculative. We don't have evidence for this. And there are ways in which it could be both moral or immoral, depending on how the system is set up.
Get a Mark. Thanks very much for the question. Lots more questions to come. Jimmy Akin is our guest. All the questions are in. They're from the internet, because it's an internet version of Ask Me Anything. More right after this on Catholic Answers Live. When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world. But it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. He's the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, where this week's episode, a new episode drops each Friday morning. This episode, this week's episode will be on the telepathy tapes, which, Jimmy, you were saying in 2025 became the most popular podcast in the world. So you're going to respond to that.
At least for a time.
Check it out at mysterious.fm or wherever you get your podcasts, or at Jimmy Akin's YouTube channel. Back to the questions we go. Jake O'Block M wants to know this. He says, "Hi, Jimmy. Like you, I changed my name, my surname in my case. I know you decided to change yours back to honor your father. How can I discern whether I have dishonored my father in changing my surname? And if so, whether I ought to change it back? Thanks so much for your brilliant work. Smiley face.
Well, thank you, Jake. I guess first I'll explain what happened with me, and then we'll look at your case and the principles that might apply to it. So I was born as a junior. My father's name was Jimmy Howard Aiken, and my name is Jimmy Howard Aiken. And that's my legal name on my birth certificate. And then I grew up, and I reached a certain point in my development in early adulthood where I didn't want to be known as Jimmy because I wanted to prove my adulthood. And so since Jimmy is a diminutive, I didn't want to be referred to by a diminutive anymore. So I started going by James, which is the root that that Jimmy comes from. I mean, well, the English root. There are even earlier roots. It goes back to the Hebrew Yaqub, and beyond that, I don't know that we can trace it. But I started going by James. Also, people would have thought it was really weird if I'd started going by Yaqub. But I started going by James, and eventually I decided to legally change my name so that I wouldn't have this disconnect between people calling me James and what it said on my driver's license and when I needed to sign legal documents and so forth. So I went through the procedure of changing my name here in Arkansas, and then I moved out to California, and I decided, you know, I'm older now. I don't need to prove I'm a man. I think that's kind of done. So I thought, you know, my name Jimmy is kind of distinctive. It's different than, you know, other people named James. And it is my father's name. And I may have, you know, kind of hurt him a little bit by rejecting that. And so I thought, I'm going to change it back. And so, and I'll honor my father in that way by re-embracing this name. And so I was in California at the time, and so I went through the procedure in California of changing my name, my legal name, from Jimmy back to James. So now I have, again, the name that is on my birth certificate. Well, that's what happened, and my father was indeed pleased. That's what happened in my case, but to what extent do similar considerations apply in yours? Well, Jake says, and I'm not... Even though he's got a name here, I assume it's a YouTube name, not his legal one. So I don't know exactly what Jake's legal name is. But he says he changed his surname, meaning his family name, not his first name. And so that's in a way, that's a little less of a direct, could be perceived as less of a direct slight to your father than what I did. Because I left my legal name, my surname, Aiken, the same. It's not like I was rejecting my family. It's I changed my first name that was the same as my father's name that he himself had, and with my mom, had given me. And so that could be more easily taken as a personal slight than another person changing their name when they weren't directly named after their father. So so your situation may not come across as the same kind of slight that mine could have. Now, ultimately, my father accepted it. He didn't complain about me changing my name, but I still realized he could, on some level, take this as a slight. On the other hand, he might not have, because he might have said, you know, I was named Jimmy too, and I kind of would have preferred being called James. That's something I don't recall us ever discussing. But that's what I did, and the same thing might not apply to you, in that it's not your changing your surname might not be taken as a direct slight to your father. On the other hand, it could be taken as a slight of a different kind, namely rejecting the entire family, not just your father, but everybody else too. So if your name, if your legal name was, say, Smith, and you changed it to Jones, it's like, why don't you want to be part of the Smith family anymore? Why do you want to change that? And it could be taken as a slight to even more of your family members. On the other hand, there can be good reasons to change one's surname. And I'll give an extreme example here, because extreme examples help make the point clear. Charles Manson, the famous American mass murder guru, had three children that we know about during his life. And one of them, his first son, was named Charles Manson Jr. And he had this long before he was a murderer, and like 13 years before he committed the murder crimes and or had them committed and had them committed in 1969. His first son was born in like 1956. And so you have this kid named Charles Manson Jr. And then when he's 13, his dad has become a hippie cult leader who is murdering people. And he becomes the most famous mass murderer in America. And that can cause problems for you if you're named after him. If you're Charles Manson Jr. and suddenly someone named Charles Manson becomes famous, or rather infamous, in America for killing people, that's going to cause you problems. And you may not want to be haunted with those problems for your entire life. And so Charles Manson Jr. did end up changing his name. So he, including his surname, I'm trying to think of exactly what he changed it to. Jay White. That's it. He changed his name to Jay White. And certainly I can understand why, if Charles Manson's your dad, you don't want to be called Charles Manson Jr. anymore. You want to be called something else, like Jay White. And so I think that's an entirely understandable situation where changing the surname is justified. So I don't know what your situation is, Jake. I don't know, you know, are there reasons why you would want to change it? Some names are, you know, names do have social resonances, even if they're not Manson. They can have social resonances that can be undesirable. And throughout history, I mean, last names are not permanent historically. People do change their names. You know, when a lot of people immigrated to America, they would change their family name, either because it was difficult for Americans to pronounce or because they'd get social advantages if they made little tweaks and made it more familiar. And that's okay. You know, that wasn't perceived as a rejection of the family. It was just, we're doing something different to try to get some advantage here. And I can imagine there are certain names that have acquired problematic resonances, like the name Lipschitz in contemporary English it has negative social resonances. And so if a family named Lipschitz wanted to change their family name, I totally understand that. I'm not going to complain about it. So I would say that I can't directly answer your question. I wouldn't view it so much as a slight on your father, but as a potential slight to the family. And if you had good reasons for changing it, and if you're, and you know, then that's fine. You can leave it the way it is. On the other hand, if you conclude you didn't have good reasons for it, and if it would please your family to change it back, and if it wouldn't cause you a bunch of additional problems, then I'd probably go ahead and change it back. But that's a major decision. You know, if everybody in your life right now knows you as Jones rather than Smith, and you start going to them telling them, oh, I changed my name to Smith now, please call me Jake Smith, that's going to cause you a bunch of headaches. And so you need to think carefully about the balance of goods here, both the costs and the benefits in this situation. And if the benefits outweigh the costs, then changing your name would be a great thing to do. On the other hand, if the costs would outweigh the benefits, then leaving your name would be the best thing to do. So ultimately, it's a prudential call. It's a judgment call. And there's no one clear right answer either way. But those are the principles that I'd bring to bear on making the decision.
Jake, that brings us to the break. So thank you very much for the question. We'll be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin internet version right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, when we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue. Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
Proclaiming the faith, changing lives.
The year was 2009. Pope Benedict XVI awards EWTN Fondress, Mother Angelica, and Deacon Bill Steltemeyer the Cross of Honor for distinguished service to the Church. It is the highest honor that the Pope can bestow upon laity and religious.
To learn more about Mother Angelica's life and the history of EWTN, visit EWTN.com/Mother Angelica.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Speaking of names, user PD1QC3YQ8F wants to know this, Jimmy. That is a heck of a name. I'll just call you user. And here's the question. Guns! Exclamation point. Is it okay to like them and use them? For example, for self-defense and use of lethal force.
Okay, so let's take these questions in reverse order. Well, is it okay to use a gun or anything else for lethal force? Well, that's going to depend on if the lethal force is justified. And there are different standards to evaluate that by depending on who you're planning on killing. If you're planning on killing an animal, then animals do not have intrinsic rights to life. And so if you, say, want to go hunting for deer meat so you can get some venison, well, okay, that's morally, in principle, okay. You know, deer do not have a right to life. And so you can, in principle, hunt them just like you could, you know, you could eat cow meat or pig meat or chicken meat or whatever. It could be deer meat. And if the easiest way to get deer meat is to go hunting, well, you can go hunting. On the other hand, humans do have a right to life. And so you can't just hunt humans, although I know that they say that man is the most dangerous game. That's a famous short story. But you can't ethically hunt humans, not using lethal force. I mean, you can play laser tag or something. But
lawn darts. Yeah.
Well, lawn darts is another issue.
It's different. Sorry, I shouldn't have contributed. I apologize.
No, that's okay. But you can't use guns for lethal force on humans without special justification, like it's a home invader or you're fighting in a war and the other guy is the bad guy. You know, or you're doing proxy self-defense. Let's say someone is attacking, you know, some innocents and they are not armed, but you are armed. You could use potentially lethal force morally to save innocent life. So, and that also applies to the second part of the question, which was using guns for self-defense. Yeah, using guns or any other tool for self-defense is in principle morally justified as long as you're using it in a situation where the use to which you are putting the tool is morally acceptable. And so you can use guns for intimidation purposes, or you can use guns for lethal purposes with other humans if you're in a situation where that will either be self-defense or proxy self-defense. So that's kind of the second two parts of the question. But now let's back up and get to the first part that deals with using guns. Is it okay to like them? Well, why wouldn't it be okay? You know, they're tools. And one can admire and like tools. You know, you could admire a well-made kitchen knife. You could admire a well. I mean, I've got a multi-screwdriver where you just change the tip on it, and it and you press the button, and it automatically screws and unscrews. And it's like, I admire my screwdriver. That's cool. We didn't have those when I was a kid. You can admire any tool, either in terms of its functionality or its beauty or its ease of use or anything like that. And so merely appreciating a tool is not a problem in principle. And some people may have special interest in tools. Like some people may want to collect knives. Some people may want to collect guns and appreciate different tools in the same category for different qualities. Like, I like this knife because it's like this. I like this other knife because it's like this. I like this screwdriver because it's like this. I like this other screwdriver because it's like that. And I like this gun for this reason and this other gun for this other reason. So I know people get all kinds, have all kinds of feelings about guns, but fundamentally they are tools. They have legitimate uses, and it's okay to appreciate them and use them in the situations in which the usage is legitimate. So I would say, you know, you need to keep things in balance. Like, you wouldn't want to buy it. Let's say you're a gun collector. Well, that's put you in the same boat as a collector of anything. You don't want to devote such attention to your collection that you end up robbing other, you know, responsibilities of the attention they need. Like, let's say you've got a family and you end up spending all your money on collecting guns and depriving your family of help that they need. Well, that would be the equivalent of saying, I want to collect, you know, Smurf toys, and I spend all my money on collecting Smurf toys and neglecting my family responsibilities. Well, that'd be bad, but there's nothing wrong with appreciating Smurf toys in and of themselves, and there's nothing wrong with appreciating guns in and of themselves.
Thanks, user PD1QC3YQ8F. Appreciate the question. The next question comes from Suzanne. It's a strangely non-exotic name after that other one. Suzanne asks, does Mary hear our thoughts? I don't always have the opportunity to say a rosary out loud. It's silent in my head. I have wondered if she knows.
Well, the standard, I mean, the church doesn't address this question in the depth I'm about to specifically, but the standard Catholic understanding is, yeah, Mary knows what you're praying, even if you're praying silently. The question would be, how does she know that? And there are different possibilities. One possibility is, well, she's in heaven, she's glorified, she's in her resurrected form, so she's got glorified resurrection abilities. Maybe she's just telepathic enough that she knows what everyone in the world is asking her about in prayer, whether it's out loud or silent. You know, that's entirely possible. We don't know what limitations humans are going to have in their glorified resurrected state. We know, we are told, we're going to be like Jesus. And if Jesus has the ability in his glorified and in his resurrected, glorified human. Yeah, see, there we'll talk about that. But since he has a human intellect in his glorified form, if he's able to know our requests in his human intellect without just downloading them from his divine intellect, then Mary would presumably have the same kind of abilities in her glorified form. On the other hand, let's suppose that she doesn't have that kind of robust telepathy. Well, the standard opinion is that all of the saints, not just Mary, but even the ones that don't currently have glorified bodies, they also know our requests for them. And the standard opinion historically has been that God lets them know, that part of the happiness of those in heaven is having all knowledge that's relevant to them, that there would be something, you know, less than optimal in heaven if there was knowledge that was relevant to you that you didn't know about. And since those in heaven have been perfected in love, they're going to want to pray for those who want their prayers. You know, that would be the loving thing to do. And so they would want to know about people who are asking for their prayers. And so God lets them know. And so he serves if I can put it this way, is a kind of internet router in heaven, because God knows he knows everything in his divine intellect. And so he can just tell a saint, hey, there's this person that wants your intercession. So one way or another, the saints are aware of our prayers, and we have biblical evidence that they're aware of that. I've done some work on that on the Jimmy Akin podcast and on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. But fundamentally, yeah, they're aware of our prayers even when they're silent, because God loves them and he loves us. And even if they couldn't on their own hear our prayers when they're silent, God would let them know. I mean, they couldn't on their own. Most of them, they're not here in the room. They're not hearing sound waves from our voices. So it doesn't really matter whether we speak out loud or whether we say it in our heart. They're not here with their ears to hear us. Mm-hmm. So they're going to need to get that information some other way. And it's possible they could get it on their own if they have robust telepathy. It's also possible that God can give it to them, because he knows what we're saying, whether it's out loud or in our hearts.
Suzanne, thank you. I hope that was helpful to you. Jimmy Akin, our guest, has asked me anything. All the questions are in from the internet. This one comes from Dave. Does Genesis 1, verse 30, really mean all animals were originally vegetarians, as many fundamentalists claim?
Okay, so we need to start by reading the text, and here is what Genesis 1:30 says. God is talking, and he says, to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the heavens, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food. So that means that the animals are authorized to eat green plants, but does that imply that they're only authorized to eat green plants? Well, I think that is one way of taking the text, because the same thing is true of man at this point. And God has given to humans the ability to eat plants at this point, since Adam was the gardener of Eden. Later, when Noah becomes the zookeeper of the ark, he's given, after the flood, the right to eat meat. And so it looks like the principle is whatever you're making a living from, you get to enjoy the fruits of that. So if you're a gardener, you get to eat plants. If you're a zookeeper, you get to eat meat. And only this is being done collectively. So after mankind initially assumed the control of the earth's flora, we got to eat from the flora. And after he assumed control of the world's animals, he got to eat from the world's animals. And so I think that this is something that the author of Genesis is depicting for us. It's like humans and animals were originally given authorization to be vegetarian, and humans at least are later given authorization to eat meat. But that's how it's presented in literary terms. That's different than what's actually true. And one of the things that the church acknowledges is that the early chapters of Genesis, specifically the first 11, contain simple metaphorical language that is not to be taken literally. And this is not a modern idea. This is something that, like, Pope Pius XII talked about in 1950. He says that these first 11 chapters contain simple metaphorical language used to express basic truths to a people but little cultured, even though they do relate in some way to our history. So I would say, with Thomas Aquinas, that the nature of the animals has not changed. So animals that are obligate carnivores today, like lions and tigers, would have been obligate carnivores before the fall. They don't have the apparatus physically to eat plants and survive. They have to eat meat in order to survive. And I would say that that Genesis doesn't go into that. You know, there's also no place where God says, and I give all the animals or certain of the animals permission to eat meat now. I think that's just not on his mind map the author of Genesis. It's not on his mind map trying to explain that. So I think he says what he says in Genesis 1:30 as a literary way of conveying a lesson about what you care for as your work. That's what you get to eat from. And he extends that to the animals here, perhaps to portray a picture of the pre-fallen world as one where there was harmony and nobody got eaten. But I don't think I think that's a literary device, and we're not meant to take the resultant implications as if they were literal.
Dave, thank you for the question. Thank you for everybody who sent questions in. If you'd like to send questions into the future, Jimmy collects them up for us. If you get them to us here at the radio department, radio@catholic.com, we send them on to Jimmy. If you find Jimmy online, you can send them to him. The internet has a lot of questions, but we'd like to get yours. So if you have them, send them. Jimmy Akin, thank you very much. I always enjoy the 2 hours with you.
My pleasure.
That will certainly do it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.